I would like to start testimony on the first bill that we have on the agenda here. So, and you don't have a quorum right at this point, so I will wait to call the meeting to order. But if we could start the testimony, Representative Knuth is with us, and she is presenting House File 1477. Welcome, Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're going to wait to move the bill until we get a quorum. Okay.
But we'll begin the testimony now. So.
Okay, great. Basically, what House File 1477 does is give us another way to get a handle on where our septic systems are, or what they're compliant or not compliant. It's another access point to that information, and that information is pretty important in terms of our water quality and our water safety and public health. So what it does is require that when a person sells a property, that they have a valid certificate of compliance or notice of non-compliance on in the recorder's office at county, and it doesn't say they have to bring the system into compliance before they sell it, but it's basically letting the buyer know what they're getting when they're buying the property, and if it has a septic treatment system on it. And then if the buyer, if there's no certificate of compliance or notice of non-compliance on record, then the seller can be liable to the buyer for the cost of fixing that system. And I have Dennis Fink, who's a St. Louis County Commissioner, here to testify about this, who works much more closely with these issues and has a few more points about the bill.
Welcome, Mr. Fink. If you could state your name, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Dennis Fink, St. Louis County Commissioner. I came here to encourage you today to look at this this bill that does the certification of compliance at point of sale, to give us another tool in the basket, and we only have three at this particular point, to be able to help us clean up our water as it relates to those issues that come around septic systems. This particular bill will help us in a number of ways. First, it will resolve the problem that buyers and sellers tend to have when a septic system is on a property and no one knows whether it's compliant or not. As you may know, compliance in many cases only requires 36 inches of separation between the bottom of the drain field and the water table. But here you would actually inspect through some certification. With that certification, the buyer and the seller then would be able to say, prior to the closing of the sale, here is what your septic system looks like. And without warranting it, it certainly says that they can, using a market-driven system, determine who's going to be responsible if the system is not in compliance. In St. Louis County, for example, we have both failure, and failures with imminent health concerns, non-compliance, and then compliance. All systems that are sold with compliance stickers get an operating statement. But if, in fact, it is not compliant, then somebody is responsible at the time of sale for how the septic system would become compliant. And it's really works well. In addition, it creates a driving mechanism for making sure that there are no non-compliant systems over a period of time. Because you're not going to get all houses are not going to change at once, but over a period of time, you would then, as a county, have a certificate within your inventory all the time on every system. That in itself leads to a comprehensive inventory, an issue for which this legislature has had to deal with a number of times in the past on how do you get a comprehensive inventory. Today, 42 counties already require a certification of compliance at the point of sale. But the issue is that if everybody doesn't do it across the entire state, then there becomes concerns back and forth as to who does the system, who does the inspection, what does that inspection mean, and a number of other points. Finally, it allows the counties to to use their existing systems or their existing resources without having coming back to legislature asking for more resources to do the inventory and bring their records to play. Now, I've got to tell you, this isn't going to take place. Just because you pass this, we're not going to have a certificate of compliance on every septic system in 2 years. St. Louis County did this the last time that 7080 was revamped, and we are now in our fifth year, and we have about 8,000 systems within our county that has certificates of compliance as a result of this practice all by itself.
Thank you,
Commissioner. Thank you, Commissioner Fink. Are there any questions for the Commissioner or Representative Coop? And before we move on, we do have a quorum, so I will call the meeting to order, and I will move House File 1477 be recommended to pass to the General Register. So are there any questions at all? Any further testimony? Seeing none, I will renew the motion that House File 1477 be recommended to pass to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Those
pass.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair, please.
Thank you. Have members had a chance or an opportunity to look over the minutes from the last meeting for March 20th? Representative Olin moves that we adopt the minutes for March 20th, 2007. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. Next, we have House File 1420, Representative Poppy. And I will move House File 1420 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Finance. And Representative Poppy to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Jean Poppy, State Representative from District 27B. House File 1420 will clarify the licensing requirements for professionals working with subsurface sewage treatment systems in Minnesota. These systems are used to treat and safely recycle wastewater from individual residences and small groups of homes and or businesses in areas not served by large centralized wastewater treatment plants. The proposed legislation is a clarification of MS Section 115.56, which establishes the licensing authority of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. It will clarify who is and who is not licensed to work on small and medium-sized on-site wastewater treatment systems. I also do have an amendment, Mr. Chair, and if you could move that as well, then I'll be able to have the testifier speak about the bill.
Sure. And I will move amendment H1420A2. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And Representative Poppy to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have two people here who are going to testify on behalf of this bill. So I'll start with Eric Larson and then Ron Jasperson will be next.
Welcome, Mr. Larson. If you could state your name, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Eric Larson from Malacca, Minnesota. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I am appearing on behalf of the Minnesota On-Site Wastewater Association, MAWA, formerly known as Minnesota On-Site Sewage Treatment Contractors Association. Our members include professionals across the state, from local governments, private industry, designers, installers, pumpers, inspectors, professional soil scientists, professional engineers, and University of Minnesota educators. We would like to thank Representative Poppy for introducing this very important piece of clarifying legislation, House File 1420. In 1994, the Minnesota Legislature authorized MPCA to license professionals designing septic systems up to 10,000 gallons per day, as governed by Minnesota Rule Chapter 7080, with no other license required. Training is provided through the University of Minnesota's On-Site Sewage Treatment Program. A professional engineer's license is required to design systems with flows greater than 10,000 gallons per day. This has been the industry practice since 1996. Since 2002, the MPCA and MAWA have engaged in a collaborative effort to create a far-reaching document that assures consistent practices in the design of mid-sized septic systems, which would be 2,500 gallons to 10,000 gallons daily flow. This need to know, which can be reviewed, by the way, on the MPCA website, it's there for everyone to check, outlines in detail the proficiencies required of all professionals who design these systems under the new 70-80-83 rule to be adopted this fall. During the need to know process, it became clear that a statutory change is needed. Language was adopted in the 1920s, long before the modern septic industry existed, that some parties interpret as requiring a professional engineer to design any septic system that serves more than one single-family home. The septic industry has proven that mid-sized, decentralized wastewater treatment systems across Minnesota can solve existing wastewater treatment demands for residential, cluster, and commercial development and protect water quality. MAWA's goal for this legislation is to have the right people with the right skills, qualifications, and authorization doing the work of designing, building, operating, and maintaining the small and mid-sized wastewater treatment systems needed to provide cost-effective protection of human health and the environment in Minnesota. If mid-sized septic systems, MSTS, design falls to engineers only, it will be by default and not by intent. MSTS did not exist when the original language was written. You will hear some engineers claim that the work is too complicated for anyone else to handle, yet they are required to take the same training from the same university instructors as non-engineers who would enter this field. In addition, the new rigorous training and testing requirements specifically address the issues involved with MSTS systems. It is a huge concern, perhaps especially to those of us from the rural parts of the state, that there will be a severe negative impact on our environment and local economies if non-engineers are eliminated from this field of work. Mom-and-pop convenience stores and resorts, small rural churches and church camps with modest economic means will be forced to sell out or close if they cannot afford high engineering fees. I have dealt with those specific situations. Secondly, voluntary updates will greatly diminish. You are all aware of the economic stress in the resort community, for example, where many are struggling to find their place in our future. Last year, there were about 16,000 septic permits issued in Minnesota. Perhaps 2,000 of these would require an engineer under the 1920s language. There are currently only 21 or so engineering firms that have septic design licenses. How would the work possibly get done? There are about 1,000 licensed septic companies, many of whom have fully qualified employees for designing these mid-sized systems. Another concern is local administration, and for those of us who live rural, this is a great concern. Can a zoning office review an engineer design without an engineer on staff? Can they inspect the installation? Can a non-engineer perform a point-of-sale inspection? This new statute is required to eliminate those concerns. Please see the handout from Cass County. I believe you had it handed out in advance of the hearing. Have you got this? Otherwise, we've got copies here, I think, if you got them. It includes a survey of 34 counties, almost 40% of the counties in the state. That issue approximately 60% of all the septic permits that are issued in the state of Minnesota. The legislature has allocated many millions of dollars in recent bonding bills and is considering allocating still more to repair failing cluster septic systems that have been designed by engineers. And we have heard engineer claims that all those problems are due to operation or maintenance issue, not to design. That is incorrect. What is clear is that the PE credential is not what qualifies the person to perform good work. The goal is proper design, installation, and maintenance the first time, which is the most cost-effective way of doing business, no matter whose business it is. The PE credential should not control the licensing. Minnesota Rule 7080 protects human and environmental health in Minnesota. With this legislation, you can keep improved wastewater treatment efforts to protect our lakes, rivers, and groundwater on track as was intended in 1994. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I might, too, if we could have this passed out, we just got a letter of support from the University of Minnesota.
Sure.
Would that be appropriate?
That would be fine.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Larson. And we have next Mr. Jasperson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ron Jasperson. I'll represent the manufacturers and suppliers of product to the on-site industry. I'm the immediate past president of MAWA, serving as president in 2006. The MPCA currently has 965 ISTS designers, Designer 1 and Designer 2, active licensed businesses, 21 of which are also licensed engineers. According to the definition of engineering in Statute 326, most, if not all, of the remaining 944 licensed ISTS professionals are practicing engineering without a license. Anyone who has designed a system that is not a single-family dwelling or more than three single-family dwellings on one system is especially at risk. The outcome of this licensure issue will have a major impact on the environment if the current workforce of MPCA licenses is restricted from doing the work they currently do. The question is about who carries the license to do the work of protecting the environment. Licensure is supposed to be about who is qualified to do the work. Statute 326 established the definition of engineering. Statute 115 charged the MPCA with establishing the qualifications for licensure to plan, design, install, maintain, or inspect on-site wastewater systems. In 1996, the Pollution Control Agency began issuing licenses to work within the parameters of Rule 7080 for systems up to 10,000 gallons flow per day. In 2002, the agency began to revise Rule 7080 and is currently proposing Rules 7080 through 7083. The proposal establishes a new license category for work between 2,500 and 10,000 gallons. Over the last 3 to 4 years, the ISTS division of the agency worked out new criteria and qualifications for the new mid-size treatment system license. This license was to be issued to anyone who demonstrated their qualifications by examination established by the agency. When the Pollution Control Agency began to finalize the new rule at 2,500 to 10,000 gallons, some within the Society of Professional Engineers pointed to Statute 326 and claimed that planning and designing septic systems falls within the definition of engineering, and anyone without a license to practice engineering could only design a system up to three single-family dwellings. This is an environmental time bomb because at any time, any engineer could file a complaint with the Engineering Board of Licensure and set a precedent to stop all non-engineered professionals from designing systems over three single-family dwellings. Now the qualifications established by the MPCA become irrelevant unless you have a license to practice engineering. This became a licensure issue revolving around the definition of engineering, not the qualifications issue. This clarification is necessary because the entire state has operated under the assumption, uncontested until now by engineers, that the MPCA is the issuing authority for licenses to design systems under 10,000 gallons per day. This clarification is necessary to assure that all professionals who prove by examination that they are qualified to design soil-based treatment systems to 10,000 gallons will be authorized to do the work regardless of the definition of the practice of engineering. The professional engineers working in wastewater treatment are convinced that the advanced municipal wastewater treatment training they receive automatically makes them more qualified to do soil-based treatment systems. The reality is that municipal and soil-based treatment are as different as night and day, and the formal training they get as a civil engineer in soil-based treatment amounts to less than about 25% of the training all ISTS professionals are required to receive. When the engineering community claims the role of being the workforce to design all septic systems over three single-family dwellings, they do so according to the definition of engineering. I don't think they realize the volume of work that does not fall within their exemption table. I don't think they realize how few licensed engineers want to do this work enough to get an MPCA license. When the workforce becomes limited, the economic law of supply and demand will have an immediate and negative effect. The financial resources for environmental protection are limited, and there's a direct and opposite relationship between the cost of wastewater treatment systems and the number of systems upgraded. This committee is charged with protecting the environment. We need this legislation to protect a sufficient workforce to do the work of protecting the environment from unnecessary litigation due to the definition of engineering. The members of this committee, as members of the legislature of Minnesota, are charged with maintaining a fair and level field of competition upon which all who are qualified, engineer or non-engineer, can compete for the work. protect the environment by saying that anyone who meets or exceeds the qualifications set forth by Rule Chapter 7080 and or the proposed changes to Rule 7080 will be legally licensed to design, install, maintain, or inspect any subsurface wastewater treatment system in the state of Minnesota up to 10,000 gallons per day. Thank you for your careful consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Jasperson. Any questions at all for... Yes, Representative Bryan.
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering if we'll hear from the MPCA on this, if it's appropriate.
Yeah. Is the MPCA here? We've got, yeah, if you would, would you like to testify? Were there any questions for either of the other two testifiers before we move on?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Gretchen Sable. I'm with the Pollution Control Agency. I've been working with the septic program since the mid-90s, and we in the PCA have worked closely with the installers since we licensed them. We've participated in their training. We've worked with them in many steps along the way. And we have also tried to work with the engineering community, and it's been only recently they've kind of engaged on the issue. The language that was amended into the bill, we are neutral on, and that's fine. We would certainly, the report section, we're able to accept that. It's consistent with work we're currently doing. We've actually set up a group to work with the engineers, the contractors, the university, and ourselves to try to address the issue, and so we would continue that work, and it's not added work for us. As far as the effective date goes, that's a good thing. The expiration date may be a little long. I'm not sure why we would need an extra 2 years after the report comes in, but you know, we're, like I said, we're neutral on the bill and would defer. So, any other questions?
Thank you, Ms. Sable. You did state that there's no fiscal note. Is that correct? Or?
There wouldn't be, no, not for the report, because we're already doing that work.
Okay. Well, thank you.
None's been requested. I'm sorry. I should have answered that differently. No fiscal note's been requested, but this is already work we're doing.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Representative Wagenius.
Just help us out a little more besides saying we're neutral on the bill. Just tell us the ups and downs and of what's going on. I think we just want to have a greater understanding of what's going on here.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, Eric's done a nice job of explaining the history of it, and Ron has talked about their position, and so that's been, we've worked with them and we concur with things they said. As the industry trend changed and more systems are larger, we've recognized problems in systems that are designed both by engineers and non-engineers, and part of it was because our standards weren't as strong as they could be, so we're doing a rule revision now to address some of that, and we're making major revisions in the training and the licensing requirements, and we think that those things will actually help quite a bit too. And so there's been problems all along, and we do believe that engineers are necessary to do some of the work. And because we don't know where it is, that's why we ended up with the report. Because we do need to continue to work with people to figure out what parts of the activities would require an engineer and what parts of the activities are more assembling pre-engineered components or things that are more cut and dry to do, I guess would be the way to say that. So is that an answer to your question?
Sort of.
Okay.
Can I have one more?
Representative Wagenius.
Because they're all interested in cleaning up our waters, and I think that's just consistent across the aisle, what is it that would make us go faster to get all of these pieces of the puzzle in place? I certainly can't dissect the puzzle right here, and that's not really my job. But it is my job to think about how much faster we can go, because we all know that we've got so much work to do.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, now I understand your question a little better. But I'm going to answer in a little different way, so give me a second here. The Board of Engineering's rules were open, around the time this issue was coming to a head. And we had suggested to them in a letter that we were concerned about a number of engineers that are currently licensed to do the work and the added cost that they may be incurred from having professional engineers involved in doing this, and because they have more costs involved in their businesses than the typical ISPS licensee, we saw some things that way. And so we put that letter into the record, and we're continuing to work with them as they do their rule revisions to do clarification and that kind of thing. So I think that we're on record saying that we were concerned about extra time and extra cost.
Thank you.
The current system that we have in place, Mr. Chair, allows people to do the work as quickly as they can. I think that, you know, there's some parts of the state where we have queues, people waiting for professionals to do the work. There's places where there's not enough professionals now. And if we cut that cadre by saying they can't do as much as they're doing now, there would be problems and delays. I mean, would it in the long run end up that we don't fix them? I don't know, but it would be longer.
Thank you. Any further questions? Okay, we also have Mr. Harvey Harvala, is that correct? I'd like to testify.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Harvey Harvala. I'm a professional engineer and chair of the Minnesota Board of Architecture, Engineering, Land Surveying, Landscape Architecture, Geoscience, and Interior Design. We regulate seven professions, and the professions that are involved in this specific issue are the professional engineers, the professional soil scientists, and professional geologists. And I think it's important when the committee reviews this particular language that we, as a board, took action by resolution at our last board meeting in February to continue our dialogue with MPCA on this specific issue of mid-sized systems. I think both regulatory agencies understand that there are some, you know, very technical and complex issues related to a growing industry. Our board is charged with protecting the public. The MPCA is, you know, charged with protecting the environment. So we have some very common interests. One thing I notice on the amendment is that our board is excluded from that dialogue, and the committee might give that some thought as to inclusion of our board, because it does get into the licensure issues. And Mr. Jasperson indicated earlier about the issue of, you know, we're sensitive to his argument about practicing engineering without a license. And I think MPCA and our board are sensitive to that argument, and we're trying to resolve that specific issue. This issue has also come up in one of our current rules processes that we're currently in process. We have a hearing on May 8th where this subject may or may not come up again, which relates to our exempt table that we're currently in a rulemaking process, and we'll have a hearing. We have a hearing scheduled on May 8th of 2007. And both MPCA, the university, and the MOA organization have placed this issue as part of our rules process on our exempt table, which had a very narrow focus, and all that rules process was doing is related to buildings. And the issue of whether these ISTS systems are even part of that process is a legal issue that probably will be heard by the hearing officer on the 8th. So at this point in time, we're involved in a, you know, complex issue with some technical, very technical engineering, soil scientists, and geologists type issues.
Thank you, Mr. Yeah. Harvala. Are there any questions? Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a question for Mr. Harvala. If only professional engineers are allowed to do some of this work, do you have enough of them to do it?
Well, I don't think our board is suggesting that only professional engineers do that. You know, that's those are user group issues. Keep in mind that we regulate the professions. Our charge is to make sure that we license competent and ethical licensees. And if it falls under the practice of engineering, that's where we come into the picture, because we have a complaint committee that actually enforces those kinds of actions. I think it's important to our board has communicated to both MOA and the MPCA that we recognize that the program that Minnesota has with ISTS is actually an excellent program with individual sewage treatment systems. It's an excellent program that the university has set up, MPCA set up, and the contractor organizations. We've talked about that in our discussions and dialogue, both with MOA and with MPCA. But what's happening, we're growing into the mid-size system, and some very technical issues are arising, and I think you just heard that testimony from MPCA. And so right in the midst of trying to resolve that, and our board took action last month to continue the dialogue with MPCA, because we think it's that important to resolve the issue, and we're sensitive to MOA's concern about, you know, practicing engineering without a license. We think that there's answers somewhere out there, but we need to resolve those issues.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Harvilla, how many licensed geoscientists do you have in the state?
Mr. Harvilla.
Mr. Chair and committee members, do you know the numbers? I would guess that, I don't have the exact numbers, but it's probably in the range of, just geoscience members, probably in the range of 500 or so.
And then, Mr. Chair, how many licensed soil scientists do you have, professional soil scientists?
I believe that's probably under 100.
And to the author of the bill, so we've got a lot of systems out there, and part of the need for protecting public health is to, I mean, the occupational licensing is to protect public health. And if systems don't get installed or are failing or are not available, then that could impact public health, right?
Correct.
I think that the bill is a good bill.
Thank you. Representative Poppy.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hansen. I'll just give you a little bit of background of the issue and why it's important in my area. I represent Austin, Minnesota, and Austin is typically flooded periodically, and the waters come down and they come through the rivers and streams and they come into the city of Austin. We have a couple of small areas that are straight pipe sewer systems. I know Representative Tinglestead worked on some legislation last year regarding trying to get away from straight pipe sewer systems, and so we have the need for individual sewage systems and mound systems and some collective systems, but these are in small areas where people, there might be three homes, there might be five, there might be 20 homes, but it's something that is a need, because we certainly know the sewage is coming down and it's coming rapidly into our city, and it adds to just the further cost of cleanup, but it also is something that we need to, because of the straight pipe sewer system kind of legislation that's gone through, we do need to be acting on this. It is something that's critical. This is legislation that helps to reduce the cost without impacting the quality of the work, and we do feel there's a strong need for it.
Any further questions? Mr. Tim Bayer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Reinhart.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I was just wondering, Representative Poppy, I'm wondering if, as the author, if you'd be open to the inclusion of this other organization in the reporting mechanism here, if there's an issue with that.
I don't think that there'd be an issue with that. I think that we'd be able to.
Would you accept that? I mean, would you be willing to make an oral amendment to that effect? I'm wondering if that would meet some of the needs for inclusive discussion here.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm maybe not the best person to ask, but my understanding is that they were on our first list to include that it was inappropriate because of the relationship with them regulating the licensing. But I can't imagine there'd be a problem with that. We'd be more than happy to have involved.
If we add that amendment, which is fine to do, we'll just get the correct name of the board to be able to add that. Can I also then on line 1.14 change the TH to the? This is so that we have if we've got that.
And if we could get that, then we need to get the name of the board. Where would you like that to be placed, Representative Hoppe?
Board of Architecture, Engineering.
It's a long one.
Landscape Architecture, Geoscience, and Interior Design.
Mr. Helen, do you have that?
I'm not sure. Minnesota Board of Architecture, Geoscience,
Engineering.
Architecture, Engineering, Land Surveying, Landscape Architecture, Geoscience, and Interior Design.
The reason they were left off.
And where would be the appropriate place? Representative Reiner, did you have a place that you would?
I'm open to the author's suggestion, Mr. Chair.
I think wherever Mr. Helen feels it's appropriate, we would add it.
Okay. We were looking at after scientists on line 12. Does everybody know what the amendment is, or does it need to be read back close enough? So, and Representative Reinhart, would you like to move that?
Yes, I would move that amendment.
Representative Reinhart moves the oral amendment. Any discussion to it?
Yeah, could you repeat it?
Is this a test?
So, any other discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Any further questions before we call the next testifier? We have, again, Mr., and I probably won't pronounce your name right. Is it Bale?
Yes.
If you could state your name for the tape, please.
Yes. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Tim Byrell. And I'm an engineer with Woodsell Smith Nolting, a consulting firm in Alexandria. We have five offices in Minnesota. I'm here representing the American Council of Engineering Companies of Minnesota. And one thing is we would also like to be added under the report section to make that request. But our basic concern here is with the medium-sized systems. The MPCA rules for the systems are quite complex, and we believe that an engineer should be involved. We're not talking that an engineer should exclusively design these. Certainly the ISTS designers should be involved as well. We think to adequately protect the public health and safety, both groups are needed. We think the cutoff for an engineer should be at the 2,500 gallon per day limit, because that would correspond with the rules and should work quite well. There's been some comments that there have been a number of systems designed by engineers that have failed. That's true. Most of those have also had ISTS designers involved with them. And I would state that it's pretty common that soil-based systems fail quite regularly. So that's no matter who designs them. It's quite a complicated thing, and that's why we feel we need to be involved in these systems, at least down to that 2,500 gallon per day issue. I don't think this is going to cause a backlog with getting systems done. There are about 11,000 engineers in Minnesota, is what I understand. And while they're qualified in many different things, there's quite a large number of them that can work with the ISTS people to get these projects done. I think that's basically what I wanted to say, and I can turn it over to Brian for questions.
Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brian Malm. I'm also a licensed professional engineer. I'm from North Mankato, Minnesota. I'm also licensed by the MPCA as a subsurface sewage treatment system designer, and also a member of the MAWA organization as well. I also serve on the MPCA's advisory committee with respect to this issue. And I'm here today testifying on behalf of the Minnesota Society of Professional Engineers, and you'll be happy to know that we are included in the report section, so we don't need an amendment to include us on that. In general, we're opposed to the 10,000 gallon per day limit. We would be comfortable if that were moved down to the 2,500 gallon per day limit, as Tim mentioned. The reason for that is, as everybody's mentioned here, the MPCA is going through a rule revision process, and they've determined that these mid-sized systems fall between 2,500 and 10,000 gallons per day. The concern we have is in there, as Tim mentioned, the rule has several specific requirements on what needs to be evaluated with these systems. One of them involves a hydrogeologic study, and for those of you who don't know, that involves an analysis of the geology of the ground underneath the system and how ground surface water entering that will interact with that geology, and it's a fairly complex issue. One of the other things that they want you to evaluate is the impact of nitrogen and phosphorus, nitrogen on the groundwater, phosphorus on related surface waters. Now, when you're talking about how those particular pollutants travel through the geology in the groundwater and how they interact with the groundwater and the surface water, this isn't a simple issue. Previous to this rule revision, that wasn't required to be evaluated. That was only being evaluated in systems that are greater than 10,000 gallons per day. With this new rule, we feel that's it's a good thing for the environment because, obviously, nitrogen in groundwater is a bad thing. Phosphorus in our surface waters is a bad thing. It's a good thing to evaluate it. And Amal is correct. The properly qualified people should be evaluating this. We just disagree on who's properly qualified to do that. Engineers have been evaluating that for years with systems that are over 10,000 gallons per day. We don't feel that several days of training, which is what the MPCA training will amount to, several days, is adequate to train somebody to evaluate those issues. Engineers, as you may know, go through 4 years of school. We get a bachelor's degree. We have to take a test prior to working, and we work for 4 years to gain experience. Then we take another test before we're licensed. We are experienced in these issues. We don't feel that a few days of training is adequate to train somebody to deal with these complex issues. To go on that, I mean, once you've determined whether there's an impact to these pollutants on the groundwater or surface water, you have to design a treatment system to remove them from the water. And again, these are things that aren't typically being done in septic systems. These are things that are typically being done in municipal wastewater treatment plants. And what you're seeing is technology that's basically municipal wastewater treatment plant technology being sized down for small septic systems, mid-sized septic systems. And we don't feel that a few days of training is adequate to train somebody to design those types of systems. Mawa brought up the cost issue. And we can't argue that hiring an engineer to design a system is going to cost less than hiring a septic system designer. It will cost more. But there's a reason for that cost, and the reason is you're hiring somebody who's properly trained and educated and experienced with these types of systems. Any design has a cost, so there's going to be a cost of design regardless. We just feel that the appropriate cost is to hire somebody who's properly trained to do the work. The question about are there enough engineers to do this, I've asked this question a few times about if the limit were set at 2,500 gallons per day, how many systems are we actually talking about being installed? I think they have a good handle on how many systems are installed across the state regardless of size, but I don't know that there's real good data on how many systems are being installed between that 2,500 and 10,000 gallon per day limit. As Tim mentioned, we contend that there are enough engineers who are who are trained in this that would be available to design these systems, and that wouldn't necessarily be a backlog. Mala mentioned that anything other than a 10,000 gallon per day limit would negatively impact their industry and their environment. We would disagree with that. Again, we're not talking about removing septic system designers from the process. You still need people that are qualified and trained to install these systems. We're only talking about the design part. People who are septic system professionals are involved typically with small systems in the design and the installation, the pumping, and inspection of those systems. We're not talking about eliminating installation. We're talking about limiting design to people who are properly qualified. On the failing cluster system issue, I think that's a valid point to bring up. There were systems that failed that had engineers involved in them. There are also systems that fail that have septic system professionals involved in them. The point here should be not that engineers are not qualified to do the systems. The point should be that these are very complex systems. They're very touchy. They require a lot of attention to make sure that they're designed properly. And we don't feel that lowering the educational and training requirement to do these systems is an appropriate way to deal with complex systems that are failing. We feel that if anything, the requirement should be increased to have problems. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Malm. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you. And Representative Fingelstad has an oral amendment she would like to offer, adding the group, the American Council of Engineering Companies. Representative Poppy, did you want to respond at all?
I think that we're okay with increasing the people that should be a part of this and, you know, helping to make it better.
Okay. Any further comments? Representative Reinhart.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to prolong this process, but I would really like to hear MPCA's response to the last witnesses.
Sure. Ms. Sable? We will, before taking testimony from Ms. Sable, finish with the amendment first. So are there any comments on the amendment or questions? Yes. Representative Fingelstad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think maybe it would go on line 11 there, probably after the Minnesota Society of Professional Engineers, probably fit in right there, the American Council of Engineering Companies, comma.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a clarification? I'm not sure, and I maybe should have asked the person who was sitting here, the difference between those two, the Society of Professional Engineers and the board. If they're representing the same people or not, I guess I don't know that.
Yeah, somebody.
I think there's somebody not. Society of Professional Engineers and the board. If they're not the same, representing the same people.
More or less, you stated.
Okay. Thank you. So the two groups are not the same. Any other questions?
Interesting.
Seeing none, Representative Fingelstad renews her motion to amend line 1.11 after Minnesota Society of Professional Engineers, comma, include the American Council of Engineering Companies, comma. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted.
Thank you.
And Ms. Sable, if you'd like to speak to Representative Reinhart's question.
Mr. Chair and Representative, there is two things that were raised I'd like to talk to. One was the 10,000-gallon cutoff. Mm-hmm. I testified in the House that we weren't entirely comfortable with the 10,000-gallon cutoff, but we felt that because the report was going to be generated and it was a limited duration time that we could live with that until we figured out the right answer. So that part, I think that we don't fully agree with the engineers and that it needs to change, but that we are concerned about it as well. And then the other issue that was raised was the number of people to do the work. And the thing that is also required is that they be licensed with us as septic professionals. And the number of engineers that's licensed with us, universities here, they had a list on their website. And I think there was 21 or 22 engineers and 12 soil scientists that have both licensures. So there would be, you know, if we were to determine that engineers were needed for that, there would be a very small number of people that we know of that would be able to do that work.
Sure. And state your name again.
Brian Mullen from North Mankato. Again, we wouldn't argue that the MPCA license would also be required as an engineer. We wouldn't have a problem with that. And on the list of engineers that's on the U of N's website, is my understanding it's a voluntary list, so it may not be completely accurate as far as the number of engineers. It was an email that was sent out. If you want to be on this list, send your name in. So it wouldn't be considered a comprehensive list.
So, Chair, if I could just have the university come down and be able to address that.
Sure. Anyone from here? We go. You can state your name, please.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Sarah Christofferson. I work at the University of Minnesota. I'd like to also highlight I've been through an engineering curriculum at the University of Minnesota, which I'm going to address as well. And as far as the list specifically, the beginning of that list came from the MPCA, but since it wasn't complete, we did a little bit further investigation, but I can't guarantee there's not one or two other people out there who could be missing from the list, but it's by no means missing vast majorities. But a couple of other comments I just want to address. I'm also one of the trainers at the University of Minnesota. There's another engineer and soil scientist who do a vast majority of our training in combination with the MPCA. We have a very successful licensing program. I actually get the opportunity to leave Minnesota every once in a while, and it's amazing to me how far ahead we are. I think that's why you actually see this issue coming to a head, in that we have designers in our state who are highly skilled compared to many other states in their abilities. Wisconsin is very similar in that very long-standing licensing programs. There's many states who don't license septic system professionals at all. If you have a backhoe and you go out and start digging. So, for instance, in Wisconsin, there is no limit about when a professional engineer is required. They're designing systems above 10,000 gallons as designers, just as a reference. The other thing I want to highlight, having gone through an engineering curriculum, the amount of training that is dedicated in an engineering curriculum to the design of soil-based systems is almost non-existent, particularly in the Midwest. There's a couple engineering schools across the U.S. that may have one course. So the argument that there's a lot more training out there around these issues, I wish there were. I wish there were more engineering curriculums that dealt with decentralized systems. But it's not all that exciting to a lot of engineering students, so they can't get students to even attend those courses. And the other comment I just want to address is the couple of days of training. The need to know that's been developed for MSTS designers will not be accomplished in a couple of days. The bar has been substantially raised for the type of training and the type of exam that will need to be passed to design these MSTS systems. I do think in the past our training was inadequate. Our licensing was inadequate to deal with these MSTS systems. That's why we see all these changes. So I think those are majority of my comments.
Thanks, Ms. Christofferson. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you. And
sorry, just one side note. We had a letter of support that was actually written by our program, and I just wanted to reference that.
Anyone else want to testify? Okay. Yes, please step forward. You could state your name, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tim Hague from Collegeville, Minnesota. I'll be very brief. I'm a practicing septic system designer, and at the risk of putting a big tart on my back, I regularly exceed 2,500 gallons a day in my design flow. When I received my degree in biology from St. John's with my environmental studies minor, I had no idea I was going to end up in the on-site world, a lot like I imagine some professional engineers may not realize that they'll end up in that coursework either. that biology degree doesn't do me any good for becoming a licensed engineer. I have a lot more use of school if I want to stay qualified if the rules do change. All I ask is that the board recognize the substantially higher bar that will be established by the new need-to-know process, of which I'm a committee member on the need-to-know committee for the 3 years running now. And I look forward to working in an industry with the higher standards. I look forward to working with engineers in that environment, along with some very qualified other licensed professionals. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Haig. Good seeing you again. Any other questions or testimony? Representative Poppy?
No, just thank you, Mr. Chair. You've provided us a great deal of time, and we do appreciate it. So thank you, and I would hope that we could see this bill move on.
Great, thank you. And I will change the motion. It appears that there is no fiscal note to this. Because of that, we could probably move this to the general register. So I will renew the motion that House File 1420, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the register, general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Next, we have Representative Thiessen. And I will move that House File 1382 be recommended to pass to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, I'll be brief, and I do have a witness with me that can explain this a bit more. This bill is fairly straightforward. You know more than I that phosphorus loads are a significant issue in the state and a concern to all of us. And this bill is a step towards alleviating that problem. It would reduce fairly substantially the phosphorus content in household dishwasher detergents from, I think the standard today is up to 8.7%, and it would bring it down to 0.5%. This bill is being actually brought forward by the people that make this dishwasher detergent. The manufacturers, and it's a bill that passed in Washington, D.C., has been under consideration in several other states. Hopefully, Minnesota can be part of that and part of that national trend, and we can kind of take this step forward, I think it is a step forward. Well, clearly it's a step forward, but a fairly substantial step forward this year. So I would like to have Mr. Dennis Griesing, is that it could come up and tell us a little bit more about the bill.
Thank you. Welcome, if you could state your name.
Thank you. My name is Dennis Griesing. I'm the Vice President of Government Affairs for the Soap and Detergent Association. I want to thank Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, and particularly Representative Thiessen, for sponsoring our bill. We are a national trade association of 110 members representing the formulators, detergents, and cleaning products and general household cleaners. We're here today to support this legislation, which was undertaken on our initiative. It would set a maximum allowable level of phosphorus in household automatic dishwashing detergents of 0.5%. That is the traditional trace element standard. And it would be effective July 1st, 2010. We are currently pursuing such legislation in several other states. In Illinois, the bill has passed the House committee and has been passed by the full Senate. In Michigan yesterday, the Senate Natural Resources Committee, on its first vote, passed our bill 4-0. In Massachusetts, we have reached an agreement with the longtime sponsor of a ban bill, Senator Pamela Resor, who is also chair of the Senate Natural Resources Committee. She has entered a bill with the conditions that we have requested. In Vermont, the legislation was passed out of the Senate committee earlier this week. This all began in the state of Washington last year in February when the state of Washington passed a ban effective on July 1st, 2010. The original date that they had proposed was July 1, 2008. based on negotiations with, and their acceptance of the conditions that we described in terms of our time requirements, they acceded to an extended extension of the effective date to 2010. And also, and this is critically important, a continued provision that allows the use of phosphorus in commercial dishwashing detergents. These are different products. They are used in different environments, and there are no substitutes for that. 2010 is essential for us to accomplish the conversion for a number of reasons. As I testified before this committee 3 years ago, there have been failures in the past with attempts to introduce consumer-acceptable products, both in Europe and in the United States in a major test market. We need the time to complete more R&D. We are hopeful that with new ingredients that have been developed over time, that we can accomplish the goal. Nevertheless, we are committed to this goal. That conversion process has begun and has been vetted at the highest levels of international companies. First, we have to do the R&D and develop the formula. Then comes perhaps the most difficult part for everybody. We will be shifting out of phosphorus. This will not be a one-to-one substitution, so we will need quantities, new quantities, and in some case of existing chemicals, and in some cases perhaps new chemicals, which may only be at the pilot stage. We need the time to build, to restructure our raw material capacity in order to enter production. Then the production lines will have to be altered to accommodate these new ingredients. Then we will need time to successfully accomplish the switch out of the new of the old product with the new. And it is, as I hope I've indicated, so that these are steps that must be taken sequentially. They can't be taken all at once. That is why we need the 2010 date. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you, Mr. Racine. Representative Cornish has a question.
Mr. Chair, not that I'm against the bill or anything, but I was wondering about the amounts. The other day when Mr. Sadowski from the PCA was in here, we were talking about, I think, TMDLs and this and that, and somebody asked him the question, what difference would it make if we took the phosphorus out of soap or something? Didn't he say less than 1% or something like that of the total? And then I heard 8% here, so I was just kind of wondering, or something like that. It sounded like a real minuscule difference. And the second question is, how many states that it's actually enacted into law, not just through committees?
Representative Thiessen.
At the first point, the 8% I was talking about was the content in dishwasher detergent now. So not, and I don't think anybody is going to argue that the disposal of lowering phosphorus in dishwasher detergent is going to solve our phosphorus problems by any stretch. But it is a step in the right direction. But I think the 8% was talking about something else.
Yeah. As a result of the debate that occurred in this very room in 2003, the MPCA was charged with undertaking a major study of the phosphorus discharge to the environment. The Bar Company did that study, and they determined at the time that 1.9% of the phosphorus discharged to the surface waters of the state of Minnesota, that is post-treatment or untreated, whatever it was attributable to household detergents, and 0.9% was attributable to commercial automatic dishwashing detergents.
In the second part of the question, how many states, Mr. Chair, how many states have actually enacted it into law?
The state of Washington.
Okay.
And as a result of that action in 2006 that we began the drafting and the lobbying effort in these other states to bring this concept forward. What would be absolutely disastrous for us would be to have an effective date prior to 2010. That would cause unnecessary increase in the cost of raw materials as we had to compete for existing capacity before there was enough to go around. That would be very harmful, in particular to several small companies like the Seventh Generation, which is also a member of the Soap and Detergent Association.
Any further questions? Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the testifier, why are we not including commercial detergent along with the household?
Commercial detergents are a special case. You have very high standards of public health, which must be maintained. The washing environments are critically different. For example, given household machine dishwashing temperatures, we have been able to substitute to a significant degree enzymes to replace some of the functions of the phosphorus. I am told, and there are experts here in the room from the Ecolab company, that at the temperatures at which commercial machines operate, because there are, which are much higher water temperatures, that would inactivate the enzymes, which are biological products, and therefore they are not as substitutable. You have higher alkalinity, you have shorter washing times, you have enclosed systems for worker safety, and the cycle is a minute in some cases.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would we be safe to say that we will see a lowering of the phosphates in the commercial ones in the near future?
I wouldn't anticipate that. The commercial world is also different in that some machines are extraordinarily sophisticated, so that the amount of phosphorus in the product does not correlate to what goes out the drain, which is what is critical. For example, there are machines that have soil sensors and other sophisticated measurement devices which calibrate the use of phosphorus on a per load basis depending on the soil loads, the water hardness and such. So the correlation is not direct. But I think the significant number was determined by the Bar company in that it's less than 1% from commercial operations. By me.
Representative Arginius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I welcome this legislation. One of the things that we've had testimony here about is endocrine disruptors getting into waters and the binding of fish that are going from male to female. And it's probably happening less here, we hope, but certainly a huge issue on the coast. Are you all hypersensitive to the fact that we don't want to see any substitutions that might be endocrine disruptors?
The industry is very aware of the debate around endocrine disruptors, yes.
That wasn't a direct answer to my question.
No, and I can't address it because my members are not going to share with me what they are going to formulate with, but I can only repeat that the industry at large is very sensitive to the issue of endocrine disruption.
When we had testimony here from a professor at St. Cloud State University, who I think impressed all of us with his breadth of knowledge and his concern about the Mississippi River, he talked about soaps as one of the carriers of endocrine disruptors. And I'm certainly hoping that you take back the message to your manufacturers that phosphorus is one thing, endocrine disruptors is an entirely different matter.
Right. I'd be happy to do that. As I said, we're rather proud of our record as an environmentally responsible industry. We've if you'll recall, back in the 60s, there were problems with foaming at some sewage treatment plants. It wasn't because those products weren't biodegradable. They just weren't biodegrading fast enough. So we went back and re-engineered the molecule. That's the kind of work we like to do.
Any further questions? Seeing none, do we... thank you. And do we have further testimony?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Maybe we could get the soap guys and the sewage treatment guys together and solve some problems.
Yes. Can you state your name, please?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I'm pinch-hitting today for Craig Johnson. I'd like to thank Representative Thiessen for introducing this piece of legislation. As many of you who have been on this committee know, the League worked and supported the efforts to reduce phosphorus in lawn fertilizer in 2002 and in 2004. And every little thing we can do to reduce the manufacturing side of the phosphorus load helps us on the other end in our treatment facilities. So we do support this legislation as one more attempt to try to reduce the introduction of phosphorus into the environment. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Are there any questions at all? Mr. Carlson. Thank you. And let's see. Anybody else want to testify? Okay. Representative Thiessen, any final words?
No.
Okay. Thank you. With that, I will renew the motion that House File 1382 be recommended to pass to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, members. And Mr. Chair.
Next, we have House File 1063, Representative Simon. And I will move House File 1063 be recommended to pass to the General Register. Welcome, Representative Simon. Welcome, Representative Simon, if you want to speak to the bill.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill, House File 1063, is Minnesota's version of the Uniform Environmental Covenants Act. It's a mouthful, I know, but it is the product of many years of work by a lot of people nationally. This is one of those uniform state laws that we see from time to time, but it doesn't even get to this place before you until it's been thoroughly vetted, as I know this has. Before I get into a brief description, which will be fleshed out a little bit more by two experts here who were part of the process, I want to assure members that this was the product of work by a whole host of interests, state and federal regulators, a lot of lawyers, real estate interests, property owners, environmentalists, banking interests, business owners, et cetera, all across the country. And what we have here is just something that's a new procedural vehicle. It's a new creature that we're creating in statute, and many other states are, and I think it's something like 13 or 14 states have passed it. The goal is to have all 50 pass it. It's not a substantive change at all. This isn't creating any substantive change. It's just a new creature, a new empty vessel that people can fill almost in any way that they choose. That's really what this is about. With that, and in the aim, of course, is to revitalize communities, help redevelop communities, and help make sure that we have sustainable, long-term enforcement of cleanup controls. And so with that, I'd like to hand it off. I'm not sure which gentleman prefers to speak first.
Go ahead. I'm Harry Hainsworth. I'm retired dean at William Mitchell College of Law and a commissioner of uniform state laws from Minnesota. And this is, as Representative Simon said, one of the most recent uniform acts, and one that's a very important one to provide uniformity across the country for this process of environmental covenants. And Minnesota has really been a pioneer in enacting the uniform acts over the years. We now have over 120 uniform acts, which is the third highest state in the country. It doesn't mean that you accept them automatically. It just means that they are carefully drafted, and Minnesota has been very, very receptive to them. In this particular case, there have been a number of amendments made, and they were made after review by the Attorney General's Office on behalf of the Pollution Control Authority, by the real estate section of the Minnesota State Bar Association, and by the environmental law section of the Minnesota Bar Association. So all those amendments have been worked into the act as a result of that process. So you have a great deal of local state review and accommodation to the state needs in Minnesota that are built into the act. With that, what I'd like to do is to turn to Commissioner Harry Walsh, the retired reviser of statutes, who can talk a little bit more about how the act actually works.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Harry Walsh, a Uniform Laws Commissioner like Commissioner Hainsworth. The Environmental Covenants Act addresses one facet of the problem of remediation of polluted land. The difficulties, often a compromise is necessary to accomplish the use of brownfields land. Without an ability to make an effective permanent compromise, it's difficult to get these properties back into commerce. Some of them are simply completely abandoned, and often owners want to walk away. This act will give us a vehicle to be used in the process that will make it easier to accomplish these solutions to remediation problems. And the solution is the allowance of environmental covenants. The PCA has authority now to enter into such covenants relating to environmental matters. I forget, it's in Chapter 84.
I don't have it right.
The PCA has authority to enter into comparable covenants relating to environmental matters. This additional authority would be usually exercised by the PCA or by some other government agency that is involved in these remediation processes. I'll go through the Act and mention a few of its salient parts. Section 4 states that various criteria for things that have to be in a covenant. That's quite a comprehensive list. It contains some sort of obvious things like legal descriptions. It also requires an identification of the problems that the compromise is trying to settle. Now, these covenants would be virtually perpetual, unlike nearly any other land covenant. They could be discharged by this procedure toward the end of the Act for doing that, but the assumption is that everyone in the subsequent series of owners would be subject to the conditions of these covenants. They would ordinarily be held by a government agency, in Minnesota quite often by the PCA, but it could be other authorities, federal or state or even local. The owners would take with notice of what these limitations are. At the time the covenant is established, all people with interest in it would have to sign off. If, in an unusual situation, the covenant were given to a private person, the PCA or the other government agency would have to participate in that process and sign off on the covenant. This law, although there have been some covenants of this kind adopted around the country, this law, which incidentally has been adopted by 14 other states, addresses the problems of numerous common law and statutory limitations on land interests of this kind. There's a list in Section 5 of the sorts of things that the Act is trying to meet and overcome. Section 6 makes it clear that this new type of covenant is to be integrated into the land laws in general, and we think that this will work smoothly with the familiar provisions for land transfers and so forth, with these provisions to overcome particular problems. Notice must be required to the affected interests, including the government agency that's involved. It's subject to record like other legal interests in land. It can be modified upon the petition of an interested party or even abandoned. If a remediation agreement or remediation procedure at some time in the future can be adopted to improve the property from where it is, the thing can be revised if all the stakeholders are involved. Generally, the lead party in this situation would be the agency, the PCA, or the equivalent agency. It is possible for one of these covenants to be abandoned if the affected parties all concur. And the rest of the Act, after Section 11, is a general uniform language that is included in all uniform acts. We do amend the provision of Chapter 115 to fix some cross-references and so forth. But we can be happy to answer questions to the extent we can.
Thank you. Representative Arginius.
Thank you. I'm trying to figure out the practical problem you're trying to solve here with this? I mean, we've had a land remediation program in effect in Minnesota for probably 15, 20 years, and I haven't heard about particular problems with it, so I'm trying to figure out what specific problem we're trying to solve. So give us a practical example of something that our current law doesn't help out with.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I can't cite a particular project, of course, because I can't think of one, but the problem that we're trying to address here is to make these deals permanent, so the conditions and arrangements that are made at the present time to remediate a problem can be carried on into the indefinite future, possibly even perpetually. And we don't have, our basic land laws do not accommodate that kind of long-term arrangement.
Maybe if I could, Representative, you've got a piece of land that is polluted, and it can't be completely remediated, but you don't want it just, but it can be used for certain purposes with certain remediations taking place, but not completely remediated. And so what this does is allows, and PCA has to prove this, so that's the key here. They have to prove the use, and they have to prove the remediation. And so what that does is if they approve that this particular use, you could use it for a parking lot, but you can't use it for anything else or something like that with some remediation, then that is incorporated into an agreement. And that agreement gets recorded in the land records. That agreement also gets sent to the authorities in the city or county or wherever it is that the land is located, in addition to the land records. So that forms a permanent record that these are the limited uses that this property can be used for. These are the things that have to be done to maintain or improve the remediation on the land. And so the least you get it back out into use again, but limited use. And that's the problem, and it's a real problem. You take trying to redevelop the riverfront in both the cities here. This problem, you're going to run into this in big time in terms of some of the land is really badly polluted, but it might be able to be used for some purposes. And so you could put a bunch of tracks together and have a development where you have limited use for some of it and broader use for others where there's not the same pollution. So that's what it's basically trying to get.
If I could, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Arginius.
It's been my impression we've been able to do this for years. And the only thing I'm hearing new is that this is a recordable instrument.
It's uncertain. They've been trying to get them recorded. What this does is it broadens the coverage and allows a broader group of individuals to be holders of the environmental covenant, municipalities and things like that, and so that they can become involved, and they can become involved in the development process as such. And what this really does is set up we would like to say uniform, but what it says is what these covenants must contain, what kinds of limitations that can be incorporated into them, so you get some standardized way of doing this. It's making them much more, I would say, attractive, particularly to the PCA and others who have to deal with these things. So you've got to set, it's got to contain all these things in it. Then you get on in the title records, and it's guaranteed that it's called a covenant that runs with the land. It's guaranteed that that's going to stay in the chain of title. So anybody buying the property or trying to use it would have to have notice of that. So it's establishing the mechanics of how you do this in a way that makes sure that it will be enforceable and makes sure that it will be maintained.
Thank you. Thank you. And we do have to move along because we have one more bill left to go through. So
we need some time for that. Are there any other questions? Representative Tinglestead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Representative Simon, to either you or your testifiers, I'm somewhat familiar with the uniform laws. I've worked with Jack Davies through the years, and I know that there was one a few years ago that I actually opposed. It was the Uniform Parentage Act, and brought in some things to our state that were in direct conflict with our existing laws. I'm just wondering, in looking through this, in our change of law last year on eminent domain, is there any issues with that new law that are counter to what you're trying to put in place here with this Uniform Act?
No.
Thank you.
This Uniform Act, Mr. Chairman, this Uniform Act will not affect laws outside of its own range. It's just set up to make these covenants more effective. They have been used, but they're not a very effective tool as they are now.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Walsh. Any other questions? Seeing none, I will renew the motion that House File 1063 be recommended to pass to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Mullery, I will move House File 294 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Cornish.
Representative Mullery's got a committee meeting coming up, so if you could keep him busy here for about 20 minutes, I can get a bunch of gun bills.
We'll do what we can, Representative Cornish.
He's got Murder Incorporated up that bill.
So, welcome to the committee, Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Did you? And I did that. I moved the bill, if you want to speak to the bill. Oh,
okay.
No problem.
Mr. Chairman, for about 30 years, when the Pollution Control Agency was started, I think it goes back as far as Gordon Rosenmeier. And it consisted of 9 members appointed. I think they were appointed by the governor. And then under that was the commissioner, and they ran the agency so that we had some outside input. Then suddenly in the 90s, it got reversed, and the commissioner took over and basically controls everything. And this bill would put it back to having citizens with outside input having influence and in controlling the agency's main policies. And we have here Grant Merritt, who was a former actual commissioner who served when the agency consisted of the members, and they had basically control of him. So he is supporting this move. And members, Grant Merritt.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Merritt. You can state your name for the tape.
Representative Mulvey, Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Grant Merritt, and I had the pleasure of serving as executive director, as it was called in those days, from 1971 to 1975. It was about 29 years from 1967 until about 1996, when the changes were made, where the citizen board, 9 members that Representative Mulvey mentioned, made the policy decisions of the Pollution Control Agency. In other words, I was the staff administrator, you might say, a little like a city manager, made recommendations, advocated for the environment, but I was not on the board, as currently is the case, nor was I the chair. So, during the first year that I was over there, I had the pleasure of meeting Senator Gordon Rosenmeier, who authored this bill back in 67. He came as a lawyer before the agency, so I asked him to come up to my office and give me the history of the formation of the Pollution Control Agency, which he did. It was remarkable, primarily for the citizen board, but also because it was independent. In other words, it's not like in Wisconsin where they have a super agency. combining the Department of Natural Resources and the environmental functions of air, water, solid waste of the PCA, or other states like Iowa and Michigan, where they have that same kind of combination or super agency. And we also had all of the functions of the environment combined in the agency: air, water, solid waste, radioactivity, noise, other functions like that. He gave me the history, and I also talked after that with John Tracy Anderson, who used to be a member of the House and became a senator, who authored the bill in the House and was helped by Representative Willard Munger, that most of us remember. The beauty of the agency during those first 30 years was that it was difficult to co-opt the agency by the industry and the entities that it regulated, because controversial issues came before the agency board members every month out in the open, and that included permits and variances, regulation, the whole spectrum of air, water, solid waste. I sat at the table with the board members, but not as the chair and not as having a vote. We had tough issues that some of you probably remember. Reserve mining was probably the chief issue for about 13 years, and NSP nuclear reactors, the Minnesota Experimental City. All of those issues would draw huge crowds before the agency board. I remember with the Experimental City, it was standing room only. And as a result, some representatives of those crowds had a chance to speak. The media covered the agency, and the public knew what was going on. The chair was elected by fellow members of the board, usually for 1 year, and it was rotated. The board made policy decisions with an even hand. The chair generally was neutral, and that's something we've lost with having the commissioner, now a member of the board, and as the permanent chair. And that occurred, as I say, in 1996. Chuck Williams was the commissioner, and with help from the governor's staff, he made the changes which allowed the commissioner to become a member of the board and become the permanent chair. And in addition, many of the functions or issues that used to come before the board were delegated or shifted to the staff. Now, I just looked at the agenda for next week's meeting of the PCA. There's one item for decision on that agenda. Sometimes they have more, but generally the meetings last a half a day. We used to have full-day meetings. Sometimes we had two meetings a month. And, of course, what happened shortly after those changes were made 10 years ago is that the citizens and the media interest quickly dropped off. And I had no idea myself that these changes were being made. They were almost completely unnoticed by the public for some time, until the agency began to slip, as I mentioned. About 5 years ago, I decided to research these changes and work on a bill to restore the board. I ran into Representative Mulry at a CLE function, and he heard me talk about it and said he'd be interested in offering the bill. And today is the first time we've had a hearing in the House. There was a hearing in the other body, the identical bill passed out unanimously from the Senate State and Local Government Committee in a previous session a couple years ago, but it went no further because they knew in the Senate that there would be no hearing in the House. They could not get a hearing here until this year. So as a result, the agency has run into problems. You've heard about the mercury issue, how that was handled, the deformed frog issue involving a staff person over there, a couple of issues like that which really did not come to the attention of the public or even the citizen board that they still have for several years. So there still is a board, but they hardly have any functions, and they really are not policy-making decision-makers anymore. These issues that I mentioned would be brought to the agency board every month. In other words, as a commissioner, you couldn't keep the issues on your desk if they were tough ones. You had to put them on the agenda and bring them to the board. So, in my opinion, it was a more efficient way of doing business. I think Rosenmeier created something unique across the country. And because of that, we got the business done quicker and more efficiently. And I think it's obvious that having a commissioner on the board and being the chair means that he or she cannot be neutral in conducting the business of the agency. And you can't be both an advocate, which is what I was when I was there, and a neutral chair. So something slipped. You had to decide one or the other. So in conclusion, I urge you to pass this bill, go back to the way Gordon Rosenmeier and John Tracy Anderson formed this agency, and maybe we will return to the leadership position we had among the states. We were once recognized around the country as one of the best pollution-fighting states that we have. And I really believe the passage of this bill will set us back in that direction and improve the performance of the PCA and avoid the problems we've had here in the last 10 years. Thank you. I'm glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. And we also, thank you, Mr. Merritt. And we also have Ms. Helen Palmer here.
Thank you.
You could state your name for the tape, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Helen Palmer, and I'm president of the League of Women Voters of Minnesota. And I'm here on playing a kind of an unusual role today because the League typically advocates for or against a given bill. As I will explain in a minute, I'm not able to do that today. I can't say that the League is for or against this bill, but I wanted to be here because to explain that we have just produced a study of the MPCA, which you now all should have a copy of, that I think will help help further the discussion that this bill relates to. Namely, what is the best structure for the MPCA to be able to accomplish its mission. That's basically what we're talking about with this bill. So I will just speak for a few minutes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing me to speak. As I say, the matter that this bill addresses, the structure of the MPCA, is a concern to the League of Women Voters, even though, as I say, we don't have a position on the moment. We, incidentally, lobbied hard for the creation of the MPCA in 1967. The publication, which we have just come up with and which you have in your hands, is entitled Examining a State Agency, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and it's the result of a two-year study by the League of Women Voters members. And like all of our studies, it is intended to educate our members and the public on an issue of importance to the state. Let me say briefly, if you don't know, that the League is a nonpartisan organization. It is a grassroots organization. It is a volunteer organization. For example, I'm a volunteer. The people who sat on the committee that produced this document were all volunteers. Why did we undertake this study? As a good government organization, we were interested in examining state agencies generally to determine whether they were providing adequate protection and enforcement for Minnesota citizens according to their charters. And we decided to look at the MPCA as an example of state agencies. And as I say, we've always been interested in the MPCA since we lobbied hard to create it in 1967. We looked at the MPCA's charter, at its responsibilities, how it is organized. We wanted to know the current status of areas for which the agency is responsible. We looked at how the agency allocates its money and asked if it has adequate funding for its to carry out its mandate. We questioned how decisions are made, if the agency operates efficiently, if it applies regulations equitably, if it holds open meetings that are clearly announced, and if there is a mechanism for citizen input. We wanted to know how transparent the decision-making of the agency of the process is. We wanted to know if the agency is responsive to all stakeholders not just being industry or government or the agriculture department or whatever, but also citizens. We conducted 33 interviews And maybe this is a good moment to point out that some four people whom we interviewed are here today. Representative Wagenius, Representative Osmond, Grant Merritt, who just spoke, and Marion Watson, who is a member of the League and who was a chair of the MPCA for, I think, 4 years back. Pardon me?
1 year.
Oh, all right. Okay, thank you. Anyway, we conducted 33 interviews, including ones with former Commissioner Corrigan, members of the Minnesota Senate and House, members of the MPCA Citizens Board, both current and former, and staff, representatives from industry, agriculture, the Chamber of Commerce, environmentalists, economists, scientists. We studied MPCA's and others' publications, court decisions, and media accounts. Clearly, the MPCA is a complex agency dealing with complex issues, and we hope through this study to shed some light on the complexity and to encourage public discussion on the issues it raises. The reason, by the way, that we have no position on this particular bill at the moment is simply one of timing. It's unfortunate timing, but there it is. Our members across Minnesota are currently reading the study themselves and coming to agreement or not, based on various questions. And one of the questions they're addressing is exactly that, that is in this bill right now, namely the structure of the MPCA, the role of the commissioner, the role of the Citizens Board. Their responses aren't due until May 1st, so you can see that our timing is a bit off on this, and I regret that. But we will determine as we go forward what advocacy role we will play. In the meantime, I'm glad to offer you each a copy of this study. And as I say, you'll find that we do address the role of the commissioner and the Citizens Board. We looked at the original structure of the agency that Grant Merritt was talking about, and we compare it to the current structure. I call your attention particularly to pages 11 and 12, where we point out the original structure and discuss the implications of the structural change that followed regarding decision-making authority, responsiveness to citizens, openness, relation to stakeholders, the role of political influence. And I would just end up by saying that the study is also available on our website, which is www.lwvmn.org, lwvmn.org. And I want to thank you very much for your time today. Thanks for fitting me in. I appreciate that. I know you're under quite a schedule.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Palmer. And we are going to be taking a vote by 6. We have to be out of this room by then. So are there any questions? Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be really brief. Ms. Palmer, I did actually look this over extensively when you sent it. I can't remember if you sent it to my home or to my office about a week ago or so. But Ms. Palmer, I'd just like to ask, I don't see any recommendations in this entire report, and I just think if you spent so much time to develop this, did you come up with no recommendations?
It's a matter of timing. We will. I mean, unfortunately, we don't have our responses from local leagues. We have 42 local leagues across the state of Minnesota. They are currently looking at this study. They're following discussion questions, and they're going to be sending their responses back to the state league office, at which point we will determine what our advocacy role will be. Yes, we will eventually take a position. As I say, the time is kind of unfortunate.
Well,
yeah, there are no recommendations in the study itself. It's typical of league studies. We do them every 2 years. Typically, we choose the delegates to the convention decide to do a study, and it's a fact-gathering kind of enterprise. That's why all the research, all the interviews, and so forth. And then league members get together and discuss what has been sort of unearthed, what kind of information we've got, and how do we think about this, and let's balance this against that.
Any further questions to testify? Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for clarification, what was the motion on this bill?
The motion is to refer it to the Committee on Finance, for it to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
Mr. Chair, this is not going to go to government operation?
Yeah. Again, I believe this is... is this one? Yeah. This is one that they're going to be rolling into the omnibus bill, and then it is exempt from going to government operations. So that's in the rules.
Nice.
On page 21, second paragraph from the bottom, it says the referral requirements of this rule do not apply to the major finance and revenue bills identified in Rule 4.03.
Mr. Chair, this is not a finance bill.
If this bill was.
But this is going to be rolled into the omnibus environment.
Mr. Chair, this is not a finance bill. I don't care where it ends up.
Yeah. Well, the re-referral is for the environment finance, but
so change the motion.
Okay.
If you look in the title, Mr. Chair, it does say modifying the structure of the pollution control agency. That's pretty major. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a discussion on the floor today about the rules of government operations, and so it would be appropriate to do that.
Okay, well, we'll take a vote on the motion to re-refer to the Committee on Government Operations. So, Representative Tegelstead.
Before we vote on that, I thought maybe we'd have a comment from PCA.
Is somebody here again from the PCA?
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Christine Johnson. I'm the Legislative Director for the Pollution Control Agency. I'll just give you a very brief statement. All of the procedures of the board are governed by state rules, and while the commissioner sits on the board, all procedures, including those involving citizen access, are established in rule and provide for a very open and transparent process. Any one citizen can have an agency decision brought before the board, and any single board member can request that an issue be brought before the board. This includes controversial decisions, including environmental review, ethanol permitting, rulemaking, and contested cases. Hearings are to be made by the citizens' board. All other routine decisions, such as entering into contracts, are made by the commissioner. The system has basically allowed us to operate at maximum efficiency with routine, non-controversial decisions while maintaining maximum public involvement in controversial matters. The result of this change in our structure would likely slow down our processes, and we're not sure we'd see any environmental benefit.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? We'll wait just a couple of minutes here. Representative Mariani.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I apologize for walking in late. We're trying to do a lot of things in this session. I'm afraid I don't know a whole lot about the makeup of the PCA, and perhaps the testifier can tell me, or the author, but who are the, what are the categories of the current 8 members that are appointed by the governor? Are there categories, or are these the citizens that are appointed by?
The citizens are appointed. There are the 9-member board, 1 member being the chair, and then 8 members being appointed by the governor. And I believe that 1 member must be knowledgeable in the field of agriculture, and the other one shall be a representative of organized labor.
Thank you. And Representative Tinglestead, I will accept the amendment to the motion as a friendly amendment. So. It will the motion will be to re-refer to the government, the Committee on Government Operations. Any further discussion or questions? Representative Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the author of the bill, we have a, first of all, Mr. Chair, this is a major issue, and they have a low number, 294, and just bringing it up on the last moment here, I think, is telling us we got to hurry on this thing. This is
frustrating for me, but I'll get past that. What I'm concerned about with the author is that we had a report from the legislative auditor with regard to the Board of Soil and Water Conservation, and the one of the things that they were concerned about is that there was that the governor did not have enough direct responsibility with that particular board, and therefore they were recommending that they establish the type of recommendations that that we have right here in this situation. I'm wondering how we reconcile those two circumstances where one board is operated differently, and the Board of Soil and Water Conservation concerns came to light with their issues. Have you looked at that at all? Is that reason for us having this before us, or what prompted this at this particular time?
Representative Molly.
Representative Osmond, I think that we have had some questions of conflict of interest. I know that a lot of my constituents contacted me about, and this would we wouldn't have that if this was the case. A number of people that I talked to thought that it functioned better under the old system for the 30 years it worked that way.
Representative Osmond.
Mr. Chair, the Board of Soil and Water Conservation has a board appointed by the governor, and they, in fact, elect or appoint the director. The legislative auditor says we shouldn't do it that way. We should actually have the head of the organization appointed by the governor. And that's exactly how we have it right now in the MPCA, is the governor is running it. And I don't understand how we can have two things going in opposite directions here, because it seems to me you want to set up another Board of Soil and Water Conservation process. Am I missing something here?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr.
I think I can answer Representative Osmond's question. The governor would still appoint the commissioner, and that's the way it ought to be. Rosenmeier was right on that. And I agree that's the problem over at the Soil and Water Board. So the governor would appoint the citizen board members and then appoint the commissioner or executive director, whatever you want to call him. So the governor is directly involved. There's no problem there.
Okay.
If the governor is appointing, how does this change current status? Because the governor appoints the commissioner now, and the governor appoints...
He would continue to appoint
the board,
but the commissioner would not sit on the board. What happened in 96 with the Williams reorganization is that the commissioner became a member of the board. And that created this conflict that we were talking about, and also became permanent chair. So that's the change, Representative Osmond. But the governor would continue to appoint the commissioner as well as the board member.
And we the Higher Education Committee is supposed to be meeting in here at 6. So, and let's see, Representative Beinart, did you have a question? Representative Tinglestead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be quick. The PCA person, Ms. Johnson, testified that a change like this would slow down the process with no environmental benefits. So with that in mind, I'd urge a no vote on this bill.
Representative Hackbarth.
And Mr. Chairman, this is a major change in the way we operate the MPCA. I would encourage a no vote and call for a roll call vote.
Roll call has been called. Any other questions? Seeing none, I will renew the motion that House File 294 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Government Operations. The clerk will take the roll. Chair votes yes.
Brennan?
Yes.
Cornish? Bill?
Yes.
Gardner? Hackbarth?
No.
Hanson?
Yes.
Hoppe?
No.
Mariani?
Yes.
McNamara?
No.
Moe?
Yes.
Olin? Osmond?
No.
Sailor?
Yes.
Scalzi? Tell?
Yes.
Tinglestead?
No.
Virginius?
Yes.
The vote being 9 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Mullery and Mr. Merritt, that we will adjourn.